What's up, War Stories fans? I want to talk to you about Ocker Leather Duty Gear for a minute. When performance is your number one priority, we all know choosing the right gear for the job is crucial to your mission success. I used Ocker Leather Duty Gear almost exclusively. If they made it, that's what I used. Ocker Leather Duty Gear gives you the confidence to perform at the highest level in the field, day in and day out. With over 40 years of experience crafting high-quality products for the law enforcement community, Ocker Leather specializes in making holsters, belts, and all the other accessories, and they stand the test of time. Let me tell you, I still have all my Ocker Duty gear, and it is well worn in, but still as nice as the day I got it. Major municipal and federal agencies from LAPD and Border Patrol trust Ocker to outfit their officers with duty gear that wears in and not out. And it's made in America since 1981, so that is awesome. Ocker is renowned for being the best name in leather, so visit OckerLeather.com and use the coupon code WARSTORIES for 10% off your order. That's Adam, King, Edward, Robert, Lincoln, Edward, Adam, Tom, Henry, Edward, Robert.com and use coupon code WARSTORIES for 10% off your order.
Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And it's been a week, and we're back for another episode. How are you doing? How's your knee?
My knee is still messed up. They want to do another injection on it, and I basically got angry because they wanted to push my appointment from Monday, this coming up Monday, to next Monday, the following week. So I lost it on the doctors, and I was like, look, has it been over 3.5 months? What are you doing? Like, unfuck yourself for something. I don't know. I was like, I don't want another injection. The first one didn't work. They're like, but this one's different. But this one is fake joint fluid. I'm like, I don't care what it is, man. Like, it's still swollen. Like, after 3.5 months, almost 4 months, it probably shouldn't be swollen.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, I gave out. I was on this is a little bit information, but I was on the throne in the middle of the night, and my leg went a little numb. And I was only on there for like 5 minutes because it gets really swollen at night.
Yeah.
And then the foot goes numb. And I was like, all right, well, I got to go stand up. And I stood up, my leg cracked. Ooh. And I fell through the door.
Oh. Well,
could not feel my leg.
Yeah, that's terrible. You need to get that fixed. You need to get a lawyer. Yeah. I'm just saying.
I have a lawyer.
Well, freaking there again, your lawyers are useless then. And you know. But you brought a guest for this week, and Dan Jackson is his name.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Damn. I really hope I'm not getting my wife's cold. I'll have to edit that out.
You know what? My wife got sick with whatever is going around, and I got sick, but I mean, we're men, so it doesn't affect us.
But when we do get sick, it's like we are dying.
No, not me.
Anyway,
just kidding. Anyways, so we have Daniel Jackson with us. He wrote the book Fallen Tigers and a couple other ones, you know, Fame, Sword and Fire and the Forgotten Squadron. Fallen Tigers is actually a pretty good book. I started reading it. I got really into it. My grandfather was a hump pilot in World War II. So he was in that area during when this book was going on.
That's pretty cool. So Dan, how are you? Tell us about you're still active duty military, correct? You're an author, but also active in the military.
I am. Yeah. Thanks, guys, for having me here. Yeah. The authoring is really a moonlighting job. My full time job. I'm an active duty Air Force pilot in Special Operations Command, doing basically advising operations right now.
Oh, right on. Wow.
Special Operations Command. That's pretty cool.
So what do you actually do? You instruct now, and you teach? Is that what it sounds like? You advise and to other pilots, or how does that work?
Yeah. So basically, I spent 8 years as an ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance pilot in special operations, deploying to Afghanistan and all across Africa, some to Southeast Asia and everything. And so then the organization that I'm in now, the unit that I'm in now, basically pulls people in with various experience, various different specialties. And then what we do is we go to partner nations and essentially help their air forces build capacity and capability to be able to create security within their own countries.
So now ISR is like AWACS, U2, RC-135. Is that what we're talking about?
No, I was doing tactical ISR in U-28 specifically.
But that's all in the same group. Like ISR is all that type of aircraft, AWACS and U-2 and stuff like that, or no?
Yeah, those are the big R, reconnaissance. Basically, our job was to sit overhead an operation. And the airplane had data links, cameras, radios, and everything. And we're working for the operators on the ground, basically not only providing them with a live video feed of that airborne perspective, but also orchestrating the air stack overhead them, and also providing a link back to headquarters and stuff like that.
Wow, that's quite a complicated gig. I'm telling you that right now.
That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, you're like the eye in the sky, but you're in real time there, you know, with the guys trying to coordinate other assets and really giving them the support they need to and the intel they need to do things in real time that they wouldn't be able to do without aircraft.
Yeah, absolutely.
That show, there's a show on right now. It's called SEAL Team, and they showcase the ISR stuff all the time. Now I'm sure it's not exactly like that, but it shows the operators down below, they're overhead, you know, and
it's Hollywood's version of it.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's basically their link to, you know, safety.
Right. Exactly. A lifeline. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, that's great. So tell us about how you ended up in the Air Force and when you came in and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I was a kid growing up in Colorado Springs. I don't come from a military background or anything. In fact, you'd have to go back to the American Civil War to find any military. But growing up in Colorado Springs, the Air Force Academy is there, and Fort Carson is there, and Peterson Air Force Base is there, and Schriever Air Force Base is there. It's,
wow.
It's nuts. So I was just sort of surrounded by it. And this is back in the 90s, before things got really forward deployed and everything. So, you know, you'd have the Air Force Navy football game, and before the football game, there'd probably be like 2 hours of flyovers. Like pretty much everything in the inventory would be flying over the town. You'd see B-2s, B-52s, F-15s, F-16s, C-17s,
that's awesome.
Everything. And so I grew up really getting excited about aviation, and decided when I was in the sixth grade that I wanted to be a pilot and be in the Air Force and everything. And so I kind of followed that dream. And so when I was in college, I just had the opportunity as a history major to meet some of the guys that are highlighted in this book and the other ones that I wrote, who started really with Johnny Allison, who was a fighter ace in China, flying with the 75th Fighter Squadron, and then ended up as a co-creator of the First Air Commando Group in Burma, which was really cool because at the time I didn't know that I'd end up in what is the First Special Operations Wing now, which is a direct descendant of that organization. And I got to meet Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot too, Dick Cole, who...
Wow. That's awesome.
Was also a founding member of the 319th Air Commando Squadron in the First Air Commando Group, which was the unit that I was in flying U-28s. And so there were some cool continuities of all of it, but they really plugged me into this community of veterans from the the ABG, the 14th Air Force, the China Air Task Force, all these organizations that were fighting over there. And it really spiderwebbed where I got to know a lot of these guys. Some of them almost quasi adopted me and really mentored me, because I didn't really have that native in my own family, folks that had that military experience. And right. So these guys would keep up with me and basically listen to my deployment stories and provide their career advice and bounce off their experience against my own and everything. And so I really felt responsible to share their stories, especially some of them that didn't get the sort of recognition during or after the war that a lot of other guys got. And that's really
the people that weren't doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Well, and even a lot of folks that did that raid went on to amazing careers, both during the war and after, that really go unrecorded after that big epic mission. And in fact, those folks are covered in this book, Falling Tigers, because those 16 B-25s that bombed the Japanese homeland were the first kind of test of what happens when American airmen go down en masse in China. And none of the Chinese knew about it. None of the government. Claire Chennault, who is in charge of the American volunteer group still at the time, wasn't told about the raid. He wasn't trusted by the brass in the Army Air Forces. And so these guys just drop out of nowhere all across Eastern China. And so it's an interesting case study, because all of a sudden the Chinese just organically basically save these people. Basically, two crews end up in enemy hands. One crew ends up in Russia, interred, and a few folks die. But I think it was 64 out of the 80 are rescued by the Chinese, totally without preparation, without any foreknowledge whatsoever.
And what's far different relationship than we have with them now, that's for sure.
Oh. Well, they weren't communists then.
Right, right. They were imperialists.
They were the nationalists.
Oh, that's true. Nationalists would be a better one.
Chiang Kai-shek's Nationalist Party was the reigning government at the time. But what's interesting, and that's another interesting thing that I'll get to in a second, but what's interesting is that following that rescue attempt, this is 1942, the Japanese go in and basically kill over 200,000 Chinese men, women, and children that participated in those rescues to basically punish them, a punitive campaign to punish them for helping the raiders. And I highlighted in the book, because what's fascinating is you look at all these rescues that happened after that. And so these Chinese civilians know what the potential cost is for helping these American aircrew, and they do it anyway, which is
right.
Something that is completely fascinating and boggles the imagination.
Yeah. And in your book, you hear the pilots say they go down and then they're asking for the guerrillas on the ground to take them to safety into villages where they can be protected.
Right.
Yeah. What's crazy is that for me, one of the reasons that I wrote this book was that the history of China, Burma, India is so fraught with politics and different partisan viewpoints, right? You've got your folks that like Stilwell. You got your folks that like Chennault. You got your folks that are pro-communist, anti-nationalist. You've got your people that are pro-nationalist, anti-communist. And so it's really hard to get to the truth, and it's all very anecdotal. Even like when you look at the air war, it's memoirs of fighter aces. And the fact is that I think there were something like 75 fighter aces that fought in the China-Burma-India theater. And in May of 1944 alone, you had 1,600 plus air crews on hand in CBI. So even they don't really make a representative sample. And so what I did was I actually created a database of every airplane that was reported missing in the China theater. It ended up being 680 aircraft on combat missions. So it didn't include the Humpy transport pilots. 680 aircraft, 1,832 airmen. And I looked at what happened to each one of them, whether they were killed, captured, rescued, or still missing in action. And what I found out by comparing that with Europe, for example, was about the same percentage were killed or missing, which makes sense because
right.
If you're reported missing in an airplane, something's obviously gone wrong. Somebody's trying to kill you. Something mechanical went wrong with the airplane. You fell victim to bad weather. And so that obviously plays against your odds of survival. So there's about 50%, a little over 50% of people didn't survive the crash or bailout, right? But in Europe, where we have these very romantic notions of the French resistance and other resistance networks across Western Europe doing these epic rescues, you had about a 25% chance if you survived, you had about a 25% chance of being brought back to Allied control by resistance networks. In China, if you survived the crash or bailout, you had a 90% chance of being brought back to Allied control by...
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, wow.
Only 5% of the guys reported missing ended up captured by the Japanese. So you're looking at over a 90% chance. And it didn't even matter. What was crazy is it didn't even matter where you went down in China. If your rescuers were communists, if they were nationalists, even if they were folks that were supposedly collaborating with the Japanese, they were still on the balance helping these guys get back to American control rather than any other possible outcome, turning them over to the Japanese, interring them. Everybody pretty much saw, regardless of what their politics were, saw helping American aircrew in the war against Japan as a good that needed to happen.
Right. So in other words, we may not agree with each other on everything, but we all agree that we hate the Japanese.
Basically. And so you even have some high profile stories. One of the guys that I interviewed who's still alive, he's 97 years old. He lives in Atlanta, Paul Crawford. He gets shot down by ground fire in his P-51 Mustang in North China and is rescued by the 8th Route Army, which are communists. And he's actually brought back to Yan'an and actually meets Mao Zedong at like a breakfast there on his way back to Allied control.
Holy crap.
And so you have this weird period where we kind of have aligned objectives. And in fact, another one of the stories is a guy that goes down across the border, just across the China border in what's now northern Vietnam, and is actually personally escorted back to Allied control by Ho Chi Minh.
Wow. Holy shit.
And then Ho Chi Minh actually uses that connection to get American help for his guerrillas against the Japanese in northern Indochina.
He was escorted back and thus established the first time anyone ever took the Ho Chi Minh Trail. they actually made the Ho Chi Minh Trail by walking.
But it's just crazy because in these stories, you see the seeds of the next 50 years of U.S. involvement in Asia, honestly.
Right, right. For sure. Especially, I mean, if, you know, you got guys, I mean, you think about it. At some point, Chairman Mao was a freedom fighter, or so he thought, a revolutionary, you know, and same thing with Mao Zedong. So it would make sense that they're running around doing their thing. And if we've got boots on the ground or you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally through an aircraft, you know, crashing, that they might run into these people. But thinking about it theoretically and then actually meeting somebody or speaking to somebody who was there and you know, did that, that's pretty outstanding.
Yeah, and it creates a whole bunch of interesting counterfactuals that you can contemplate as well. Like was our view in the Cold War too black and white? Like, especially with Ho Chi Minh, like, we had this cooperative relationship during the war. Did we toss that out too quickly just because he was associated with communism, even though there were a lot of divisions between him and communist China, between him and the Soviets? Did we create an enemy where there didn't need to be one? Is there, here we have this, then also this wartime alliance between unofficial, but very effective between the United States and the Chinese communists in northern China too. And it creates all these questions over, like, were there different outcomes available from that?
Right.
And are there ways that we can have a more nuanced view of these sort of international political situations that create more possible outcomes and hopefully outcomes short of conflict in the future?
Well, you know, you think back to all those kind of sliding doors moments of World War II that created or could have created different scenarios. I mean, Patton, when they reached Berlin, you know, Patton said, okay, we're gearing up and going to Moscow, right? And everybody went, no. And he goes, guys, you know, but if you think about something like that, that decision, if Eisenhower had and Churchill and all of them, if they had genuinely backed the idea of going to Moscow, how things would have changed from World War II. Same kind of thing. If we had taken a more nuanced view of relationships with some of these people that were allies or, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend during World War II, we could have potentially avoided a lot of issues, specifically speaking of Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam. You know, when the French, you know, fled Vietnam and we had to help the South Vietnamese, you know, or we decided to help the South Vietnamese. I don't know how much we had to. You're right. The calculus changes if we had, you know, made some different decisions based on relationships or, I guess, interactions with characters like that when we were allied with them against a greater enemy.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because it brings out some of the mythology that we've built around ourselves from World War II as well. And I think it's interesting because if you look at the American experience, you have the revolution is kind of the founding myth of America, but World War II is really the founding myth of the American superpower. But there's some interesting, like, problematic things about it, right? Like, we liberate Western Europe from 4 years of Nazi oppression, but then simultaneously condemn Eastern Europe to 50 years of Soviet oppression, you know? So there are these interesting trade-offs that happen as a part of that, that are interesting to contemplate, especially as we enter this new era of great power competition. Are there different ways that we can do this stuff that realize better outcomes, that realize better outcomes for the people that are in those areas, and that also reduce the possibility of armed conflict? Right. Because one of the big things that I get from talking to these veterans of World War II, we have this very maybe John Wayne movie influenced view of the war, right? Where it's this kind of grand and glorious thing.
Yeah, white hats and black hats.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, one of the guys that I interviewed for all of my books, Dave Hayward, who's a B-25 pilot in China, he talked about with me about how his squadron was actually originally in India flying missions into Burma and then came to China at the beginning of 1944. And in the first 12 weeks that his squadron was in China, they lost 12 airplanes, which was 75% of their authorized strength.
Oh, damn.
And so, like, I can't imagine, you know, when my squadron lost an airplane on a deployment, it was devastating, you know? I can't imagine losing, like, half the squadron
right.
in 2 months.
Right.
And so you think about that, those kind of traumatic experiences that those guys went through that is kind of brushed off in a lot of the way that we view the war now. And I think that's stuff that needs to be brought more to the fore, because when we start making decisions that might lead into another big war, like a peer, near peer war, like that's the kind of stuff that hits the people that are fighting it, is that they're losing right. an enormous amount of friends.
It's not a one-sided conflict like so many others. Like Vietnam was for all intents and purposes a you know, an even playing field for many reasons. You can get into us being handcuffed and not being allowed to use our full military potential, and you can get into guerrilla warfare and how we were fighting in the jungle, and you can get into all the whys and hows. But if we had brought our full military might to bear, we really could have just invaded Vietnam and destroyed them, right? It could have been done. But the ramifications of that are so far reaching, and the things that would have been triggered by it became, because of the Cold War, an impractical option. It just wasn't going to happen without sparking possibly a third world war, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, when I think of what you're talking about like, you know, level playing field, like an actual conflict where, you know, two nations are fighting as hard as they can against each other and they're of relatively equal strength. We haven't seen that probably since World War II.
No. And I think the only thing that you can guarantee in that kind of situation is that a lot of people are going to get killed.
Exactly. Which is, I think what you're to speaking to your point is why in a lot of our conflicts, you know, we don't see 75% reaction force strength getting decimated in 2 months. And we think, oh, it's devastating to lose, like you said, lose a plane. But you think about like the story of the Memphis Belle. The story of the Memphis Belle was amazing because it was the first aircraft that had ever completed all of its missions. That's pretty hardcore when you think about how many missions were going on. And this was the first plane to complete all of its missions. First one.
Yeah, it really gives you an appreciation for how gutsy a lot of these guys are. And then you take like that kind of atmosphere and you overlay it on China. And some of the big differences that it's crazy. You have these people that go through the same training system, right, in the United States to become pilots or navigators, bombardiers, whatever. And they're parceled out all over the world. And people in Europe have such a different experience and are really, for all practical purposes, fighting a completely different war than people in the Pacific and China. Mm-hmm. Where you're fighting from these British bases in these, you know, real runways and everything like that, with real logistical support and everything like that, in a Western country with that speaks the same language as you, that has similar political values and similar culture to you, all that stuff. You look at these guys that are in China, they're flying from austere bases that were hand-built by tens of thousands of Chinese laborers that speak a completely different language, have a completely different culture. Everything about this war for the Americans that fought it is completely alien to them. And so for them to be able to have that comfort of, if I go down and survive, I will most likely be brought back by friendly forces, was just a huge piece for their morale in prosecuting this war over there. Because the alternative of being a Japanese prisoner wasn't good. And if going through my database, if you were captured, even though a few were captured, you had about a 26% chance of not surviving that experience.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, if somebody told me, hey, you know, you got a 26% chance of dying, that's a significant, you know, that nobody wants to hear that number. And to know, to then say, well, not only is that the number, but what you're doing is completely voluntary. Like, you know, it's not like I'm giving you a terminal diagnosis or I'm giving you a diagnosis where you've got a 26% chance of death. You're voluntarily going to do something and voluntarily taking on a 26% chance of death. And the mental fortitude that it takes to do that anyway is, you know, it's great. It's inspiring.
And it really defies understanding, I think, to a big extent as well. But it's pretty crazy some of the mindset that these guys had, though. Like, one of the guys I interviewed talked about how he shows up at his squadron and his new squadron commander hands him a 38 caliber pistol and says, here, you know, take out as many of them as you can if you go down, but save one for yourself. That was the kind of mindset that they had going into a lot of these missions.
That's so, you know, chilling. What's interesting. Yeah. You know, what's interesting about that is I met when I was a young teenager, my mom knew a guy who was a pilot in Vietnam and I believe he flew F-4s and he still had his revolver and shoulder, you know, chest holster that the pilots wore. And he brought it out because he knew I was, you know, even as a teenager, I was a history buff and into the history of warfare and wanted to talk to him about it. So he brought out his gun, he showed it to me, and he told me that, you know, it had 6 shots. And he said, so I could take out 5 of them and I had to save that last bullet for myself. And I remember being, you know, 12 and looking at this man who just coldly and calmly told me, yeah, I could take out 5 enemies. And then if, you know, they started to approach my position and it got bad, I would just shoot myself in the head. And he said it so matter of factly. I'm like, this guy's balls are so fucking huge. It just made a huge impression on me. Like, yeah. That mindset of that was the way it was. And we just did it. It impressed me so much. And I said, that's the kind of person I want to be when I grow up, where when there's a job to be done, you just fucking do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too, though, because, and I think this is a good initiative to try and capture a lot of those stories, you know, because one of the overwhelming pieces of feedback that I get from family members of folks that whose stories end up in these books is that, oh, dad or grandpa never talked about this. Like, he never told us about it. And I think part of it is because it's something to the layperson that is so completely unrelatable. Like you just said, like,
right.
Like the layperson would be like, just like, how do you even get to that point?
Why would you kill yourself? Just be captured. Yeah, exactly. They can't fathom that.
My grandfather never spoke about anything that he did, especially not to me. He died when I was really young, but he never spoke to me about anything that he did while he was over there flying as a hump pilot. But I guess he told my dad. And when I told my dad I was doing this podcast, my dad sent me paragraph texts about stuff that he, that he did. And I'm like, man. And my dad says one thing that they were constantly trying to shoot those guys down, and they lost a lot of guys when they were over there. And I'm like, well, that's probably why that he didn't really want to talk about it, because he saw his buddies being taken out. I mean, it's just crazy. And he never spoke about it. The only time that we would do anything together, and this is my fondest memory of my grandfather, was building all the aircrafts and models that he flew.
Yeah.
And we decorated them. We built them. We would hang them up in his room. And, you know, and I got a couple of them when he passed. And then to hear my dad just start opening up about the stuff that he was told by his father, I was like, that's crazy.
And, you know, what's interesting to me, and Chuck and I have a little bit similar perspective on this, because my grandfather was a bombardier in World War II, but he was in the Royal Air Force. So he was on a Lancaster. But I built model airplanes with him as a kid too, and it kind of influenced my, I my love of aviation, but also like, you know, building models with him was a big deal. And I now, as an adult, I think back to building those models with my grandfather and him telling me just some of the fun stories, the hairball ones. It was probably a little bit therapy. Right. It was probably a little bit, it was the safest way to open up about his experiences as a bombardier in World War II to his grandson, where I was little, I couldn't judge him. He could share something he was passionate about. He could instill that passion in me. He could tell me fun stories. And I mean, I don't remember if he ever got choked up telling any of this stuff, because I was little and I probably wouldn't have picked up on those cues anyway. So I was probably a more safe place, a more comforting place for him to impart those things, and working on those models was probably a bit like therapy.
Yeah. Especially that's crazy too, because as you know, Bomber Command in the Royal Air Force had the highest casualty rate, I think, of any British formation during the war. Yeah. Is pretty horrific. And I actually get into that a little bit in the book too. One of the guys that I really focus on, Glenn Bonita, starts the book and ends the book. And he was also rescued by, he was actually one of the first two American aviators rescued by the communists, which really sent him into unknown territory. Nobody really knew how Americans would be treated by communist troops, like whether there would be any cooperation, because no like real formalized relationship existed at the time. So nobody really knew what was going to happen. But when he got home from the war, he didn't talk about it at all to his kids, his wife. He was, he'd seen a lot of gruesome stuff, but then also he was, I think, a little ashamed at having been shot down, like felt some shame at having been shot
down. Which
is
crazy.
It is, but it also makes sense. You know, if you're a fighter pilot, you're a type A personality person, you know, who did all this training to be a fighter pilot, and then to be in a dogfight and to be shot down, to be bested by the enemy is a humbling experience to say the very least. Right.
Yeah.
And then to be completely at the mercy of these locals who pick you up and get you out of there at much hazard to their own lives and everything. And so for him, it was this interesting journey. You know, he started opening up when a lot of the veterans groups started forming in like the 60s and 70s. And Tex Hill created one. Tex Hill, who was an American volunteer group base who stayed in China and then actually went back on a second tour to China. He actually formed a veterans group for the veterans of the 23rd Fighter Group. And so Glenn would go to these and, you know, see his old buddies from the war and everything. And so he started opening up, like you were saying, like tell more of the fun stories, the things that were funny, the things that were weird. But he didn't really like delve into the trauma much with his family still, right, until he actually went back to China in 2005 and actually got to journey to the place where his plane was actually being excavated from this lake. What was left of it, crashing. He actually got to meet some of the individuals who actually helped rescue him, some of the civilians from the town, some of the Chinese troops, some of whom actually went on to be really heavy hitters in the People's Republic of China. One of the guys who was just a lieutenant at the time, ended up retiring as a general. And then the commander of the division who actually rescued him actually became one of the presidents of the People's Republic of China.
Wow.
And so he had this eye-opening experience of going back and kind of hit him like what all of this meant in a really emotional way. And so for the last 5 years of his life, it was all about, he was all about telling these stories and sharing as widely as possible and going back and sharing the story with the Chinese people, coming back, sharing this story with the American people, because he all of a sudden kind of recognized the importance of opening up about it. But it was a process for him for sure.
Now, I don't know if I've shared this story on the podcast, but in the vein of fun stories, one of the ones that my grandfather shared with me was their plane got hit and they were going to go down. And my grandfather immediately, you know, says, okay, it's time to bail out. And my grandfather goes to the door and for all intents and purposes, leaps out of the aircraft,
mm-hmm,
and feels a hand grab him and yank him back into the aircraft. And it's the radio operator. And my grandfather looks at him and goes, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm stopping you. And he goes, why? And he says, I got to jump out of the aircraft. And the radio operator says, not without a fucking parachute. And so my grandfather had panicked so hard. He had taken his chute off. He wasn't wearing it. Didn't put it on. Goes to bail out of the aircraft. And the radio operator sees him jump out without a parachute and pulls him back in, you know. And that was one of the, you know, funny stories. So my question to you, Dan, is in doing all this research and in hearing all these stories, do you have a favorite?
Oh, man. That's a great question.
Or one that sticks out to you as being like, I love this story.
There were a few. I think one of the ones that I've visited actually several times in my book and has kind of subsumed part of my own life was this big dogfight that takes place down in Thailand. Thailand was allied with Japan at the time. And so 14th Air Force airplanes were flying out of Southwest China and basically interdicting roads and railroads down there. And they get into this dogfight with Thai fighters, I guess. But these...
That's amazing. I'm using that for the rest of my life. What do you call the planes in the Thailand Air Force? Yeah, Thai fighters.
Yeah. In the Royal Thai Air Force over northern Thailand. And this P-51 pilot, Henry Minko, ends up getting shot down. And I knew his best friend, Cliff Long, and had interviewed him and had interviewed other people in the dogfight too. Is really interesting because at this point in the war, this is late 1944, the average skill level of a Japanese pilot had gone down quite a bit because attrition was so high. And so they encounter these Thai pilots. They think that they're Japanese because they're flying Japanese, very outdated Japanese fighter types with fixed landing gear and everything like that. And these guys end up being super high time dudes, very aggressive, and they're flying, they're outnumbered 3-1, and they're just sticking with the dogfight the whole time. And in fact, in the reports afterwards, the American reports were like, hey, we didn't expect this. These guys were super aggressive. But anyway, Cliff never knew what happened to his friend. He just didn't come back from the mission. And so I've been corresponding with the Royal Thai Air Force Museum since like 2007 about this stuff, just looking for more information. And it was cool because, you know, I got to see the side of the story from the Thai pilots' perspective. They recorded how they saw it and everything. And so we found out that this pilot, this P-51 pilot, had peeled off by himself, gone after this Thai fighter and overshot it as he was flying up this valley towards a mountain. And so all of a sudden he's overshot the enemy fighter, but has to pull up to avoid hitting terrain. And consequently, this Thai pilot who'd been had the just been shot up really bad, thought he was about to die, had one of the bullets like hit his ankle, like his fighter was had holes all throughout it. And all of a sudden this P-51 just pulls up right into his gun sight. He's like, oh, okay. He pulls his trigger and the thing crashes into the mountain. And nobody had been able to find it. And so through the relationship that I built with Sakpanay Promtep, who was the museum director at the time and then later retired as a 3-star air marshal of the Royal Thai Air Force, who himself had a lot of great stories too of flying American attack aircraft in like the post-Vietnam era against insurgents in Thailand and stuff like that. But he ended up, there was a big flood in Thailand. They ended up finding all of these police reports from the war. And all of a sudden they had these reports from police officers that actually responded to these crashes that included specific locations and everything like that. And so we were actually able to go to these places in Northern Thailand. I went in 2018 and 2019 and actually interviewed folks that witnessed these actions from the ground. And we were actually able to go up into the mountains, which was the worst hike I've ever been on in my life. It was like 2.5 hours to go 2.4 kilometers. Ooh. And I was the cargo pockets were ripped off my pants. This is like straight up like machete through the jungle type stuff. And we actually found the wrecked P-51 Mustang up in the mountains. And now the Defense POW MIA accounting agency is going to return to the site. They did a site survey just a couple months ago and recommended the site for excavation, full excavation, because they think that it's likely that remains can be brought back to the United States.
Wow, that's so amazing.
That was cool for me to kind of show how this research, kind of fusing the archival and interview research that I did in the United States with interviewing folks and finding archival sources in China, Thailand, Vietnam, and like being able to do something with it, like having this actionable information, being able to go to Northern Thailand and find guys that are still missing to hopefully be brought back home, even though it's been 75 years since they went down.
Right. It's like, I know this great story. Well, awesome. What are you going to do with it? Oh, yeah. We can actually recover the remains of downed airmen from That's foreign crazy. Soil and return. It takes a cool story and turns it into an amazing arc for, you know, that pilot who gave his life during that conflict and his family. I know somebody who experienced the joy of having their grandfather's remains returned from the Korean War. She did the research and she, you know, her family was on top of it and her grandfather had been MIA in, you know, the Korean War. And when they finally did the math and did the research and found out that where his remains had been, they got him back. The joy of that, you know, you're providing that to a lot of families and you're doing it, doing something you love. I think that's awesome.
It's so much closure.
Yeah. I think it's just something that we owe our service members too. It's like, hey, we're not going to leave you there, you know?
Right. The no man left behind, whether it's 7 minutes or 75 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's really cool.
So that's awesome. I'm gonna have to get a copy of the book, both for me and for my dad. I love history of warfare and you know, I've had it's kind of weird. What's that? There was a movie where somebody's had an ancestor die in every war, and then they're convinced, and they go into the next war, they're gonna die. You know, kind of a thing. Forrest Gump. That's the one. I couldn't remember what it was. You know, I trace back my dad's side of the family. We had somebody in the Revolutionary War. We had somebody in the Civil War. We had somebody in World War One. We had somebody in World War Two. So, you know, all the way down the line. So that you know, creates this love of history. So I'm going to definitely read this book, but also because of a personal tie-in, because you're, you know, talking about the Flying Tigers, and we were talking before we started the episode, is where I live, our local airfield is named after our hometown hero, Pappy Boyington, who was one of the Flying Tigers. And I mean, he as far as combat ace pilots go, you know, there's few names in World War II that come up, but his is always mentioned.
Yes.
And he, you know, for those of you that grew up, that you're my age or older, and you grew up watching Baba Black Sheep, the Black Sheep Squadron, you know, that's Pappy Boyington.
He was definitely a character too. One of his, one of the things that made him unique is that he was such a mess, if you will, that he actually got kicked out of the American Volunteer Group, which was, you know, a mercenary organization with no like real rules on discipline or anything like that. Wow. And they're like, hey man, you need to go. Like, this is too much. He'd lost a couple of airplanes. He like landed out in a couple of airplanes once because he just got lost. He didn't like take the maps with him or anything. And maps were hard to come by in his defense, but he also didn't pay super close attention all the time necessarily. And then there are allegations that he scored most of his kills while like completely drunk, or at least a little buzzed. We don't
know. And so here's my thing with that. You're just telling me stuff that makes me like Pappy Boyington all the more.
Well, I'm not telling you not to like Pappy Boyington, but he was a character.
That's for sure. I mean, he's one of those like he kind of joined up and said, fuck it. You know, I'm going to write the rule book instead of following it.
Yeah. Well, and the whole reason that he resigned his Marine commission too and joined the American Volunteer Group is because the pay was good and he was so bad in debt. Because he was so bad with money, which worked out pretty well because that $500 bonus for every Japanese airplane you shot down went a long way in 1942. So
hell yeah. I mean, how many paratroopers had no idea what a paratrooper was in World War II? And when they said it's an extra $50 a month, they're like, I'm in. You know, you end up with great heroic stories all based off of a pay bump.
Well, you got to survive first.
Right.
With such a high chance of death, I mean, would you not want to be a little bit sauced up when you went out?
Hey, but you know what, though?
Mom's nerves.
I was just going to say, like there's like, you know, there's stone cold sober where nerves are actually working against you. Then there's one or two shots in where you've got just enough liquid courage that you're on that razor's edge. And then there's like shit face drunk where you, you know, you're just going to auger in. There's like that sweet spot.
I've got over 1,000 combat hours in the U-28 from 7 deployments.
And I'm sure all of them were sober. Let's just preface
them,
that.
All of those hours are very sober. But I will say that one of the traditions that hasn't lasted to the modern day from World War II was the whole mission whiskey. Like when you got back, the flight doc met you in debrief or at the edge of the airplane and gave you your shot of whiskey that was like actually, you know, sent out as a part of the mandated supply for all of these units. Like everybody after the facility got a shot of whiskey to cool down, to spin down from the thing. So that would have been nice.
I mean, it, you know, I'm down for it. We kept the challenge coin from World War One, right? Isn't that where the challenge coin started with the volunteer fighter pilots of? I'd heard this story. Maybe you can speak to this. So the story I'd heard about challenge coins is that volunteer pilots fighting in the European theater from the United States in World War One were rich people with airplanes that could afford to mount guns to them and then just fly missions in World War One and help the French out. And that because they didn't have a uniform, one of the guys had coins struck, and you had to have that coin with you at all times to be able to show the French that you were fighting on their side and that you weren't a German. And so there was a very famous story that this guy had been shot down and he was going to be captured and executed as a collaborator, as a traitor. And then the only thing he had on him was the Germans had not taken his coin, right? When they captured him. So when he escaped, he was in his, you know, prison uniform, but he had his coin in a leather pouch around his neck. And when the French found him, they were going to execute him. They found the coin. They realized he was one of these American pilots. They then took him in, reunited him with his unit, and gave him a really nice bottle of wine to thank him for coming over and helping the French. And thus the challenge coin was born, that you better have it on you at all times, 'cause it's going to save your life. And if you, and if you present it, you get owed a drink.
It's funny because one of the things that we see from China that I talked about a lot in the book actually is the whole notion of blood shits, which started because a lot of the Chinese civilians who had never seen a foreigner before in some of the rural areas that they lived, they didn't know what the difference was between like an American and a Japanese. So the Chinese government ended up giving these guys a like piece of silk that was about 9 inches tall that had a picture of the nationalist flag. And then it said basically in Chinese characters, "Hey, this foreigner came to fight on our behalf, like help them out," because a couple of guys had landed out and the Chinese thought that they were Japanese and took them prisoner. And it was like really awkward, like the whole process of like, no, this is an American and they're on our side.
Yeah, right.
Like several days to get them extricated from those situations. So they ended up getting all these blood shits, which is very famously depicted on like the backs of the American Volunteer Group flight jackets.
Right. When you see those flags on the backs of those leather jackets, it had a purpose. You know, yeah, now it's cool and decorative and vintage and bitchin', but it served a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's a piece of evasion equipment that we still use in modern times.
Wow. Now, Dan, I got a question for you. How many of these pilots were commissioned by the Chinese?
Well, so are you talking about Chinese pilots or
American pilots being commissioned or getting a commission through the Chinese in that time?
So there were 100 pilots that actually gave up their commissions in the U.S. Army Air Forces to join the American Volunteer Group and went and flew as what we would call today, like private military contractors, technically
mercenaries.
Yeah. Technically in a unit of the Chinese Air Force. But they were never actually commissioned in the Chinese military. They were just PMCs. So subsequent to that, everybody that came over was commissioner, non-commissioned officer, or soldier in the U.S. Army Air Forces. So none of them actually served technically in the Chinese Air Force, except for this really cool unit called the Chinese American Composite Wing, which was this initiative to actually rebuild the Chinese Air Force during the war, since it had been so decimated by the Japanese before the Americans even got involved, like 1937 through 1940. And so basically they sent off Chinese pilots to the United States to get flight training. And then they came back and they served in units that had Americans and Chinese through every level of command. So there'd be an American squadron commander, a Chinese squadron commander, co-commanding the unit, Chinese flight commander, American co-flight commander. And so it was actually a Chinese Air Force unit that was co-commanded and staffed by Americans and Chinese. Fighting in the war there, which was a pretty cool initiative and kind of the forebearer of the kind of work that I'm doing now in the aviation advising realm.
Yeah. I was just curious, 'cause when I was telling my dad all about this stuff, he wrote me, he was like, you know, grandpa, he told me all the pilot, planes that he flew and that he was a pilot in the Himalayas doing the transport aircraft and the called hump pilots and all that stuff. And then he was actually given a commission in the Chinese Air Force and a medal from the Chinese government for his service as a hump pilot. So I was just curious.
Yeah, a lot of people were given awards by the Chinese government, and justly so, because especially when you look at the hump, after Burma was taken, that was the only route of aid into China. And so the only reason that China was able to actually not surrender to the Japanese was because of folks like your grandpa. And so, yeah, a lot of them were given Chinese wings, a set of Chinese wings. A lot of them were given awards by the Chinese government and everything.
So these aren't commissions so much as tokens of appreciation.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Well, that's all. I mean, man, this stuff fascinates me. I'm going to have you. We have to have Dan back, Chuck, to just come and talk about actually flying in theater like for real, it, because the history stuff, I'll do that all day long. We didn't even get to you talking about your experiences. So you got to come back on and talk about some of your experiences. Would you mind?
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, that'd be great. Hopefully you can talk about, how much of that stuff is
how much is that
classified?
Can you talk about, right?
Yeah, exactly. How much can you talk about?
Well, quite a lot of it is classified, yeah. So, but we can talk
about we'll figure something out. Well, we always let our guests, we try to dedicate every episode to brother or sister officer, firefighter, or veteran who died, lost their life in the line of duty. And so we just usually give that opportunity to our guest first if they have somebody they want to dedicate their episode to.
Yeah, I think especially considering the content of this, there are two names that I'd like to bring up. Henry Minko, who is that pilot that went down in Thailand, you know, early 20s, and through getting to know his story and then being a part of it, I guess, in a way, I just feel like I got to know and appreciate him and the sacrifice that he made for us, you know. And then the other one is George McMillan, who is a pilot in the American Volunteer Group and then went back to China and was commander of the 449th Fighter Squadron, which is what I wrote my first book about. And they were the only P-38 fighter outfit in China during the war, and probably just the most outstanding squadron commander. Like, never would tell his men to do something that he wouldn't do himself. And so as a consequence of that, took on some of the crappier, more dangerous missions and lost his life over there as well.
Those were the Lightnings, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just an awesome guy. And in fact, really pushed back against some of the, you know, what he saw as a stupid mission and got ordered to do it anyways. I don't think he was even planning on going on that mission, but when it became stupid, he decided that he had to lead it and was consequently shot down.
Yeah.
So I think of those guys, and I've got a picture of him in my office and stuff like that, because it's kind of leadership that I feel like in the modern Air Force, we, in the FGO realm, like he was a lieutenant colonel when he died. He was also a lieutenant colonel at like age 26, but whatever.
Wow.
I think that's kind of leadership that we are our guys, you know, to not get hung up on ourselves or on our promotions, but to, you know, do what we ask our people to do and to lead from the front like that. So he really exemplified that and gave his life as a consequence.
Well, we appreciate you bringing those guys up, and rest easy, brothers. We got it from here. You mentioned something in your first guy that went down in Thailand that I wanted to bring up, because I think that people kind of gloss over this. And I wanted to really try and drive this point home, because it's something that also applies to my grandfather. You just said he went down in Thailand in his 20s, right?
Yeah.
We think of World War II veterans as frail old men at a parade with their cap, with all their, you know, their VFW cap with all their pins on it. And, you know, you got to remember, that's not how old they were when they were doing this.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of a pilot going down in World War II and you say, oh yeah, he, you know, went down, da, 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 you think of the age of World War II veterans. You think of a grown man. This man was a kid.
Yeah.
A youngster. My grandfather lied his fucking ass off. He joined the Royal Air Force when he was 16. And subsequently, my grandmother found out when she married him at his first birthday party after they were married that he was about 4 years younger than what he had claimed to be. But funny. He lied his ass off. See, these are children. These are kids. Yeah. These are young men. So when you talk about, you know, somebody's, oh, that's my grandfather, and they got his remains back. He died at 24, and he left a pregnant wife at home, and you know, all these things. So when you think about these remains that are being returned, when you see these black and white photographs, just remember that these were young, vibrant men, not you know, the ones that you see that are old and wrinkly, those are the ones that were lucky enough to come back.
Amen.
You know, these fresh faced photographs, you got to remember, these were 21, 22, 23 year old kids that said, I'll go. They raised their hand. They said, I will go. I will answer the call, you know? And so I really wanted to highlight that, because I think what you said was really key, and people tend to gloss over it, is that these aren't adult, like mature 40-year-old or 50-year-old men. No, these are kids.
Yeah. I'll just say, I think that's a great point, because Dave Hayward, who I mentioned earlier, who's, you know, his squadron lost 75% of its airplanes in 12 weeks. He just died back in February. He was 98 years old.
Yeah, good for him.
But he always carried around kind of this guilt that he made it and they didn't. And when his last words, his son was sitting by his bed and he'd been in and out of consciousness, and he just like kind of comes to consciousness and just grabs his son and like utters one word, which was just fate. And that was the last word that he said. So he really struggled with that, being one of the best.
He was contemplating all the way up until the end. He was contemplating the nature of why some survive and others don't. That's how powerful that was.
That survivor's guilt is unreal.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure.
And the dedication to the service that these men had in World War II and World War I was just unparalleled. It's amazing. And the street savagery that they were, and the stuff that they did, that some serious balls in these men.
Well, and I know these aren't our war stories. These are someone else's war stories, which is a little bit different than what we normally do. But Chuck and I both feel that a war story is a war story. And sometimes we need to step up and tell the stories for the people that can't tell stories for themselves. That's why we dedicate our episodes to brothers and sisters that have, you know, paid the ultimate price. But it's also why Chuck and I want to start doing more of these, like, you know, profiles. We've had people contact us, and we've debated it. We've honestly debated it. And we, if you guys have feedback as an audience, you want to tell us, but we've debated having the relatives of people who were killed in World War II, who have had stories shared with them, come on and share the stories of their relatives, because those stories are just as important. And it's my grandfather, if he was still alive, he'd be on this show and he'd be talking massive amounts of shit and telling great stories about World War II, but he's not. So I think it's important to share those stories for him. And same thing with Chuck's grandfather. You know, Chuck's grandfather shared a couple of those stories with his dad, but, you know, clearly it was still difficult to talk about. So it's important for us to recognize them and tell those stories for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Dan, I want to say thank you very much for coming on. While reading your book, I could really tell the craft that you put into it and the heart that you put into it. I mean, it's a really good book. I felt like, and I'm not a pilot, but I felt like I was in the cockpit on many of those stories. And just the way that you talked about the gear mechanisms and, you know, the traffic coming through the radio and just the crazy dogfight stories. I really, really, really liked it. Not to mention that my grandfather was in that same era of flying. So I really felt a connection to it. I can't wait to finish the book. I mean, it's amazing. And I think I literally read for hours straight and I was like, man, and then on my Kindle. And then I was like, oh,
this which is hard for Chuck, because he doesn't know how to read. He kept flipping the pages on his Kindle, waiting for a picture. And he was just, you know, didn't come.
They have a Hooked on Marine. It's a written in crayon. So it was a little bit easier for me to read.
Right.
No, but it was really, really great.
I love it. Anyway, Dan, again, appreciate you coming on. Hope to have you on again. If you write another book, let us know. I need to go pick up a copy of your book for sure. At least for myself, but if not, for my father as well, because he will definitely appreciate it. We tend to buy historical books. Like I bought Band of Brothers and then bought him a copy of it. And he bought me the book about Eisenhower after he read it and da da da. So we tend to send each other good historical books. So I'm gonna have to send him this one. Chuck, do you have anything else? Really good.
Real quick. One, I'm going to say thank you again. Two, I bought the book on the Kindle or the Amazon, but I'm going to be buying the paperback or the hardcover so that I can display it with all my other, Army Air
Corps. Yeah, you got to buy a freaking paper book.
Yeah, this was way faster hardcover, just to buy it on the Kindle, but I'm going to definitely buy that so I can display it on my bookshelf with all the other, hump pilot books and all the other, World War II books that I have. And then also, if you guys want to come on the show, booking.warstories at Gmail, or come onto the Instagram, DM us at warstoriesofficial there, or come onto the our Facebook, War Stories. Give us a follow on Instagram, and then contact me either through the Instagram or through our email, and we can set you up for a slot on the show. May take some time, but we will get there. And so,
yeah. And the book is the book. Once again, I want to give Dan a chance to tell people how to contact him if they need to. But the book is Fallen Tigers: The Fate of America's Missing Airmen in China During World War II by Daniel Jackson. He's a great author, but he's also a military man himself. I'm assuming, Barnes and Noble, Amazon, all that kind of stuff.
Yep. All those places, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you can find it. And then you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/forgottentigers. And that's my author page there.
Very cool. Dan, we appreciate it. And until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.